it's not an application or a methodology, it's a way of life. It's once you perceive the world in a different way, then everything changes. You don't have to think, oh, tomorrow I'm going to do step 1, 2, and 3. It's just there. So I think, you know, that's the main thing also, is this is not a professional tool. It's a practice that runs right the way through every moment of every day.
Wollen wir doch diese Konferenzen Kubernetes nennen.
Wir müssen lernen, systemisch zu denken.
And what do I want to explain? Observing and the observer.
Er fragte sich nicht warum, sondern in welchem menschlichen Bezugssystem würde dieses Verhalten Sinn haben.
Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu Cybernetics of Cybernetics. Das ist dein Podcast zu Kybernetik zweiter Ordnung und systemischer Theorie.
Hallo und herzlich willkommen zum zweiten Teil des Gesprächs mit Nora Bateson. Für die, die mich noch nicht kennen, ich bin Lina Nagel, Kybernetik-begeisterte Sozialwissenschaftlerin und befasse mich schwerpunktmäßig mit Kommunikation und Konflikten, insbesondere in Unternehmerfamilien. Nora Bateson ist die Tochter von Gregory Bateson und führt die Arbeit ihres Vaters und Großvaters William Bateson fort. Zum einen als Gründerin des International Bateson Institutes und zum anderen mit dem Warm Data Lab Format, das sie entwickelt hat, um, so würde ich sagen, kybernetisches Wissen in Bezug auf Lernen, Entwicklung und Beziehung in die Welt zu bringen. Zwei Zuhörende haben mir rückgemeldet, dass sie gerne mehr zum Warm Data Lab gehört hätten. Und das kann ich gut nachvollziehen, denn ich habe ja wirklich nur gesagt, dass es mehrere Stuhlkreise gab, die unterschiedlichen Kontexten zugeordnet waren. Ich kann mir vorstellen, dass es mehreren so ergangen ist. Deshalb danke für den Hinweis und ich werde noch mal ein bisschen was ergänzen jetzt. Zu Beginn hat Nora Bateson ein bisschen was erzählt. Ich erinnere mich daran nicht mehr im Detail. Aber der Aufhänger war Unternehmerfamilien, weil wir waren ja bei der IFERA-Konferenz, die sich rund um die Forschung zu Familienunternehmen und Unternehmerfamilien dreht. Und es ging dann auch um familiäre Beziehungen. Und woran ich mich noch erinnere, ist, dass sie erwähnt hat, dass sie noch recht jung war, als ihr Vater gestorben ist. Ich gehe aber davon aus, dass sie da nicht immer das Gleiche erzählt, sondern dass das stark mit dem Kontext zu tun hat, in dem das Warm Data Lab stattfindet. Es gab dann, wie gesagt, so kleine Sitzgrüppchen und die waren jeweils einem unterschiedlichen Bereich zugeordnet. Also sowas wie Erziehung, Ökologie oder auch Wirtschaft. Es waren vielleicht, ich weiß nicht mehr, 6 oder 7 Stück. Und die Vorgabe war, dass man ganz flexibel zwischen diesen verschiedenen Bereichen wechselt. Also, dass man sich vielleicht kurz verabschiedet, aber sich wirklich frei fühlt, jederzeit auch zu gehen und dann in einem anderen Bereich mit den anderen Leuten weiterzusprechen. Außerdem gab es eine Impulsfrage, die sie zu Beginn reingegeben hat, über die man sprechen sollte, und das war: What is risk in a changing world? Also was bedeutet Risiko in einer sich verändernden Welt? Und über diese sollte man dann in Bezug auf den jeweiligen Bereich oder Kontext, in dem man saß, sich mit den anderen dort unterhalten. Ich habe mir auch noch notiert, dass Nora Bateson gesagt hat, dass von ungefähr 100 Trainings, die durchgeführt worden sind, es immer einen Gesprächsfluss gab, der sich entwickelt hat, und nie Meinungsverschiedenheiten. Das fand ich nochmal interessant, weil daran hatte ich mich ja auch beim letzten Mal noch ohne die Notizen erinnert, an diese eindrückliche Erfahrung, dass trotz der potenziell konfliktstoffbergenden, kontroversen Themen sich nicht ein konfrontativer Schlagabtausch ergeben hat, sondern wirklich gute Gespräche. Mir sind auch noch ein paar weiterführende Hinweise eingefallen, wenn ihr euch für Nora Bateson und ihre Arbeit interessiert. Dazu werde ich am Schluss der Folge noch ein bisschen mehr sagen. Jetzt kommen wir erstmal zur heutigen Folge. Zum Schluss des letzten Teils hatte Nora das Beispiel eines Löwen mitgebracht, der eine Antilope jagt, um sein Hungerbedürfnis zu befriedigen. Und sie hat das als Lösung erster Ordnung beschrieben. Er hat Hunger, er geht jagen, er isst. Und sie hat beschrieben, dass das kein Problem ist, dass der Löwe nicht das Ökosystem bewusst berücksichtigt, weil seine Problemlösungsstrategie ist Teil des ökologischen Kreislaufs. Also sie hat darin eine Funktion, dass er die Antilope jagt und frisst, wirkt einer Überpopulation an Antilopen entgegen. Und es gibt noch viele weitere andere Zusammenhänge, die den ökologischen Kreislauf am Laufen halten. Sie hat dann gesagt, unsere Wünsche, die wir anstreben, die sind häufig anderer Kategorie. Also die produziert eher eine Welt mit neuen Störungen und dass es wirklich einen Verlust der Fähigkeit gibt, das überhaupt wahrzunehmen. Sie hat die Fragen in den Raum gestellt, ob wir jemals auf diese Weise wahrnehmen werden und auch, ob wir jemals auf diese Weise wahrgenommen haben, dass wir solche Zusammenhänge verstehen und erkennen. Und genau an der Stelle setzt das weitere Gespräch nun an.
I think there's some disagreement in the neuroscience world about that. I would suggest that contrary to a lot of neuroscience, I think that we come perceiving that way. We arrive as babies able to do that. Mm-hmm. And it gets taught out of us. Our language pushes us away from it. The implicit messages in our families, the implicit messages in our schools, in our riding the bus, I mean, it's, the messages are everywhere of what it means to survive and to be alive in the modern world. So when we go to fix a first order problem, we do it wrong. Now, what's ironic is that the biggest first order problem that we've got is the ecology. So the irony is it takes thinking in an ecological way to actually respond to an ecological problem. You can't respond to an ecological problem with industrial first order thinking. And that the hitch is that you might think you could get away with it if you just had a, like we were saying today, a big enough spreadsheet that you could just put all the organisms in the spreadsheet and maybe the AI can do the math. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't work like that. Those relationships are, they're at depths that are unreachable from what we know. I mean, why do you fall in love? We don't know, we just don't know.
Right. Yeah, and it's like with the lion, like him getting the antelope is actually making him keep his environment that he can live in, right? But for us, not to consider the whole circle, we often do things that actually harm us because they, for example, destroy the environment or just make changes that in the long run, they will eventually harm ourselves. Mm-hmm. So,
and I think and that's others. It. I mean, basically, yeah, you're talking about all of colonialism.
Right.
Industrialism is premised on colonialism. I mean, it goes way back.
Right.
And it's a real difference, okay? So in there's a violence in breaking relationships that make relationships that make relationships. Where if you have a road, okay, and you're driving on the road and you see that someone has hit a deer, and there's a dead deer or a dead badger or a dead raccoon or something on the road.
Mm-hmm.
And you think about how that creature has sensitized over thousands of years to know when there's a wolf or a fox, to know when there's a storm, to know where it's safe to lay down and give birth, where to sleep, where to eat, where it, like all the sensitivities that are there. But that organism does not know how to know when a car is coming.
Right.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's happening in another dimension.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes a violence. I saw this great cartoon that said, it's not that the deer crossed the road, it's that the road crossed the forest.
Mm. Right.
Right?
That's like also like, you're not in traffic, you're part of the traffic.
Yeah.
Right?
Right. So there's a real difference in breaking relationship or a lion eating an antelope, which is actually making relationship in the savannah. Okay,
mm-hmm.
This is something that we do not understand very well.
You said, if I got you right, that it's something that we would have naturally when we were born, but through socialization and society, it's changing, right? We have other ways to go about it. So is a solution to get more aware of, let's say, the whole circle of connections, like how everything is connected and also leads back to us? Or what would you say is the best way to go about it to not hurt relationships or like trying to solve problems in a way where we're creating even bigger problems eventually?
Well, that's a question that I would definitely not want to answer. Not because I don't have a lot of thoughts about it, but because I think if we start off looking for a solution, we're going to be caught in the thinking that's creating the problem.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not trying to be cute. I'm really absolutely serious here. I mean, you know how many gazillions of projects there are out there about how to change people's mindset or raise their consciousness or 10,000 other forms of how we're going to make you actually more like me.
Right, because, right.
Which is better.
Which is
obviously.
Obviously.
If everyone was
right.
And I can't go there. I just cannot go there. I just have to tell you that there is no part of me that feels like I could ever want you to change. That's
right.
Not my business.
Right.
It feels absolutely like a violation for me to be sitting here thinking, now, if she just did this, 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 and this, then she would measure up to this.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Or we would be in a better world.
The world would be so much better.
Yeah.
And I do not come from there. I never want someone to feel like I'm here to change them.
Right.
I'm not interested in that. What I am interested in is when they start combining their own ideas and experiences in lots of contexts, where will it go? What will happen?
Mm-hmm.
What will they discover? And the fact that we don't know is really exciting to me. What will happen?
Right.
And what insights will pop up? And where, so I, you know, for me, I feel like all of these projects where we create these models and we're gonna make the world better because we're going to take this model and we're going to stamp it everywhere. We're going to figure out how much water each humanoid needs and how much protein and how much and how they're going to live their lives and how they're going to think and how they're going to feel, how many hours of sleep they need, you know, how many steps they should walk in a day.
Mm-hmm.
I find that whole concept just totally horrifying. We are in a living system. That means that all the organisms need to do what they need to do. And then what is important is how the relationships form. But that's the second order. And we are caught always dictating the changes that need to be made at first order. Right. No one tells you that when you go to that, you know, guru mindset consciousness raising class, that you're going to come back and you're going to be a jerk and your friends are going to be like, shut this person up. They used to be nice, but now I can't listen to this anymore. Suddenly, my righteous friend is an egomaniac. And I mean, I can't even tell you how many times I've seen that happen. So for me, the whole thing is much more humble. You and anybody else, and I mean anybody, has the possibility of being in whatever little crooked tree you are right now, and how you grow that crooked tree into being forms possibilities of other relationships. So the question is not what are you doing? The question is what's possible because of what you're doing, right? I don't, it's not about who you are. It's about who I can be when I'm with you. That's an ecological relationship. But we've got decades of marketing ploys for how you can improve yourself.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And not much about how it is possible for people to be with you, who they can be.
Erinnert ihr euch noch, dass ich im ersten Teil des Gesprächs gesagt habe, dass ich es eine Herausforderung bei diesem Podcast finde, die Dinge zu konkretisieren, ohne sie dabei zu stark zu reduzieren oder zu pauschalisieren? Ich finde, das, was Nora gerade gesagt hat, passt da sehr gut zu, denn ich habe sie ja gefragt, was könnte denn eine Lösung sein? Und das Erste, was sie gesagt hat, war, dass ihr nichts ferner liegt, als anderen zu sagen, was sie tun sollen. Dass sie zwar einige Ideen dazu hätte, was Lösungen sein könnten, aber dass ihr das widerstrebt. Und sie hat dann den Fokus von der Frage, was zu tun ist, hingewendet zur Frage, was wird denn möglich aufgrund dessen, was wir tun. Und das finde ich total interessant, denn da drin steckt für mich, immer wieder in jeder unterschiedlichen Situation zu schauen, wie man damit umgeht. Also keine eine pauschale Antwort festzulegen. Und außerdem auch unterschiedliche Handlungsoptionen zu beleuchten. Und sich eben zu fragen, was geht denn damit einher, wenn ich es so mache oder wenn ich es so mache. Also anstatt ein, wie man in der Systemik sagen würde, Tooligan zu sein. Ich weiß gar nicht, ehrlich gesagt, wer diesen Begriff geprägt hat, aber ich habe ihn das erste Mal von Matthias Ohler gehört. Also jemand, der exzessive Tools benutzt und Methoden in jeder Situation. Ja, anstelle eines Tooligans vielleicht ein Situationigen zu sein. Das ist natürlich kein runder Begriff, aber eben jemand zu sein, der in jeder Situation immer wieder neu schaut. Und was da ja auch noch drin steckt, finde ich auch sehr interessant. Wenn ich neu schaue, muss ich auch immer wieder selbst entscheiden. Also es ist auch ein Thema, was mit Verantwortung zu tun hat. Und Position zu beziehen, indem ich mich nicht auf ein vorgegebenes Verfahren beziehe, was ich von jemand anderem bekommen habe, sondern indem ich eben in jeder Situation wieder selbst neu entscheide und mich auch selbst frage, welchen Umgang damit finde ich denn richtig oder welcher ist denn für mich passend? Ja, das Thema geht schon in die Richtung der nächsten Folge. Da geht es nämlich um Kybernetik, also mit einem großen E in der Mitte. Aber wir hören mal weiter in das Gespräch rein. Ich habe natürlich trotzdem noch mal ein bisschen weiter nachgehakt, aber hört am besten selbst.
I had to think of Heinz von Förster, how he differentiates between being part of the world and being a people person. And he says it's a decision that either you decide that you are a part of the world or you're looking through a people from outside, right? So, and I was wondering what is a way, like, how do you, could you go about it if you see that other people look from outside and think, oh, I have a like superior perspective on things. You kind of maybe gave an answer already because you said you would never tell someone, hey, you're wrong for doing this or you should change to reach a certain kind of level. But still, do you have any other thoughts on that? Like if someone is like, let's say, behaving in a first order solving problem way, like do you have a certain way to deal with situations like this, or how do you go about it if you experience that?
Well, you're not going to like this, but there's no methodology.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, here's the thing. I mean, either you're responding to the complexity or you're not. So, you know, if I am thinking, okay, well, here's my methodology. I've got this manual that tells me if I have this script and that script and this script, that this is how I should deal with someone who's being confrontational or who's being a racist idiot or, you know, this is what I should do. This is how you handle this situation. My whole life and work would tell me no.
Right.
What you do is you pay attention to the complexity of this person.
Right.
And you begin to perceive them as a complex organism, as a being that has learned to be in the world in the way that they are being. And it may be ugly, but it's how they've learned to be in the world. So how do you respond to that? And the only way to respond to that is to respond from the way you've learned to be in the world. And but with a different question, not of how do I be right or how do I teach them a lesson, but how do I make room for them to actually be in the world in another way? And that may not happen in 5 minutes. It may take time. It may take years of them being in relationship with you before they can begin to perceive that it's possible. It might take 5 minutes. In my experience, it's usually very quick. You know from the way someone is looking at you. Just because someone isn't saying something doesn't mean they're not communicating. And if you're in communication with someone who's sitting there thinking, oh no, you're one of those, you know that. And what kind of response does that bring?
Lead to, yeah. I like your answer because it is in this, it is in a second order way of thinking that you're not telling someone, because then you would be a people person yourself in that moment, right? Yeah, but still, I think it's still interesting to explore, and also like what you can always do is ask questions to see where they come from, right? Like you said earlier, I had the when I forgot what I wanted to say, it was actually a quote that I remember from two German psychologists that say the behavior of an individual, it always makes sense from their individual perspective. because of all the things they've experienced before. Like, even if you look in from the outside and think, oh, it's such a bad behavior, or they're doing a crime or something crazy, from their personal perspective, it still does make sense. So I think that's a really a good way to approach people, to have this in mind, and then it would be more like connecting or seeing how is the connection, or asking questions, and eventually if I say not looking in from outside is also like setting a rule. So,
and I think it's interesting to look at the market for these, you know, developmental mind shift programs.
Right.
And also say, well, what is the context in which this craziness makes sense?
Mm-hmm. Because it is very popular,
it's
right?
Very
There's
popular.
Books about it, a lot.
And,
yeah,
and so I want to have the flexibility to be able to perceive that and not be thinking, oh, that's just nonsense. Right? The question is, why is that so predominant? And what might allow it to move?
Right.
And not because it should or shouldn't move, but because the movement itself is interesting.
And understanding more about it, right?
Yeah.
That can, yeah.
Yeah. So on the one hand, I don't want to be in a place where I'm vilifying mindset programs any more than I'm vilifying a lot of other programs out there. There's a lot of things going on right now that don't make sense to me. And people are getting sucked in to all sorts of actually very decontextualized, mechanistic programs for how to do a thing, whatever the thing is, make it great again, or make it change its mind, or raise its consciousness, or, you know, whatever it is. But in all forms, it's the same problem. It's inherently unecological thinking. And the question, if you are living in a meadow or a savanna, and you are a butterfly or an earthworm or a lion or an antelope, the question is, how does the savanna continue?
Right, and not how does the lion get more antelopes, right?
Yeah. So, and also, there's no redwood forest in California if there's no savanna in Africa, and there's
right.
no Pacific Ocean if there's no, right? So this is what is important about this nth order question. I guess the main thing is just relax and make room for things to happen. And that seems to be so difficult. It seems like whenever there's room for things to happen, there's this anxiety to dive in and start trying to make it do something to your end. And that's pretty much what we're seeing.
Yeah, actually it can be really relaxing in a way, right? To have this mindset, because it also means you don't always have to intervene. You don't have to fix something, which doesn't mean don't do anything or don't stand up for what's important for you, but it's not like having to change everything or being in charge, like, let's say, a manager having to be in charge of everything, or a coach having to have a certain outcome for his client, right? It's like a way of being more relaxed.
And I think this is a interesting question of how do you take a stand in a complex system? Because who are you if you don't?
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I told you I felt quite passionate about wanting to be careful around how people get labeled, or what happens with those labels. Um, what I have to say is that taking a stand almost always involves coming into something from a direction that is probably unanticipated. Something that allows the different contexts and the complexity to move. And that thing is not going to look like first order change. So you take a stand, but it's a stand at a different, in a different place. And I think that needs a lot more exploration of how to do that, to allow healing to take place, if you want to call it that, to allow learning, which I mm-hmm. would say is synonymous with healing. And what does that look like? More than likely, it doesn't look like a direct fix.
Right.
So that much I can tell you for sure. What it will look like, I don't know. But it's not an application or a methodology. It's a way of life. It's once you perceive the world in a different way, then everything changes. You don't have to think, oh, tomorrow I'm going to do step 1, 2, and 3. It's just there. So I think, you know, that's the main thing also, is this is not a professional tool. It's a practice that runs right the way through every moment of every day. So there's this story that starts with this question of the people used to always ask me, because, you know, listening to all of this and paying attention to all these contexts, and it just all sounds like, yeah, but my brain will explode, right? And how am I supposed to take all this into consideration when I just need to do a thing?
Mm-hmm.
And so people would ask me, hey, did you ever see your father in an emergency situation? And I said, no. And then I thought about it. And I remembered that there was a day when we were in the car, and I must have been 9, maybe I was 10, but I think I was 9. And we were driving down Highway 1 in Big Sur, California, which is a teeny tiny little road with a large drop down one side to the Pacific Ocean and a mountain up the other side. It's very beautiful, but there's nowhere to pull over. It's not the place to have an emergency situation. And on this particular day, I was going to a riding lesson, actually, and my father saw a hitchhiker on the road, and he loved people.
Mm-hmm.
He loved stories. So he picked up the hitchhiker, and this young man jumped in the car, and he put his rucksack in the front seat, and we closed the door to the Volkswagen van, you know, whatever, 1978, 77, and we're driving along, and within a couple of minutes he pulled a knife out.
Oh.
And he was holding it to my father's side while he was driving the car. Now, my father was a terrible driver anyway. He was always looking at the whales on the trees and the, like, anything except the road. So I was in the back seat. And it occurred to me this might have been an emergency situation. But it actually wasn't an emergency situation. And why not? What happened? Well, what happened was my father saw this knife, looked at the knife for very briefly, looked at the person who was sitting there, and he said, well, what have we here? And then he asked the man, so how did you get yourself into this mess?
Mm.
And the man began to tell a story. And pretty soon he relaxed, and he was holding the knife in his lap. And we drove, and they continued talking. And it must have been 45 more minutes. Finally, we got to where he was going. And my father gave him a little money from his wallet and our home phone number.
Oh, wow.
And and said, if you ever need anything, just don't hesitate. Okay, so what happened? What happened was that my father did not see a man with a knife. Mm-hmm. Okay? If he had responded in first order, he would have responded to the man with the knife. And the knife would have been what he saw. But he didn't see that. He saw a man with a story. And so he asked about the story. Now, the thing is that you can't just go around doing this like a prescriptive. You can't make a methodology out of this. Don't think if you get a knife pulled on you that you're going to try to repeat
right.
what Gregory Bateson did.
Yeah.
Okay, because it's absolutely specific in the minutiae, okay, in the way he had no blush. He was not flushed. He was not afraid. He was not manipulating that man.
Right.
This was not a manipulation. This was genuine curiosity from one human being to another in that car, in that day, in that way. And you can't duplicate it or scriptify it or make it into a program.
Right.
What you can do is spend the next several decades of your life practicing perceiving contextual process. And then maybe you'll be that good. I'm still hoping that one day it'll happen to me. But that's what it takes. So
right.
there's no hack. There is
yeah.
no quick code. There's no shortcut. You know, either in those moments, you're either perceiving that or you're not. And because the guy would know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's all the way through the body that communication that says, hey, wow, what happened?
I think that's a really great example to show how usually like a first order solution would lead to a bigger problem. Like if you sit there and think, oh, this person is a problem, I have to get rid of him, or I have to do something about this, I have to fight him or whatever, it might cause an even bigger problem, right? And how then by seeing the person who's there, that's what it was about too, right? Seeing him still as a person, not as a threat or a danger or a problem, seeing the person still, it made a huge difference in the outcome, right? So, wow.
And there was no spike of adrenaline in the car. There was no moment when I, as a child, felt that my father was afraid and defending me.
Right. That's why you didn't come up with the situation when you were asked if you right, were in a dangerous situation.
There was no emergency.
Yeah.
It never. There was the emergency part of that emergency never
wow.
even happened.
That's really impressive. And I think also is such a good example. I like how you said, like, don't try to copy this, don't try to repeat it, because every situation is also different. Like, it's going to be a different person, with a different agenda eventually, right? So there's no one way to go about it. It might be different all the time, but...
It will be.
Yeah.
It has to be.
Right.
It must be.
Right.
And that's the curiosity.
Yeah,
is into the millions of particulars that are possible. Yeah.
Thank you for this example. I think, it shows really great, not how to have like a set way of going about things,
mm-hmm.
but maybe one thing you can take from it is to, look at the person or be in touch with the person. Like, also what I said earlier, like asking a question is also something that would make a connection to the person first, right? Instead of having a...
Sometimes yes, sometimes
mm-hmm.
no. I would
right.
avoid any kind of instructions, because sometimes the best thing you can do is a look, is a smile, is a breath.
Right.
You know, there's so much communication that says... you and I as organisms are here together. So how do we want to do this?
Mm-hmm.
And I think if we get into, if you ask a question, then you're going to start trying to get tricky with the right question.
Mm-hmm.
And there you go, you've just popped out of it again.
Right.
You've caught, you're down another rabbit hole of how do I manipulate the situation with the just right question? And as long as you're in that manipulation mode, you're in the manipulation mode.
Right. It's interesting how I always try to grab some essence and you're like, no. If you do that, it might be like manipulation. I get it though, I get it, okay.
I mean, you know, when someone says, so how, you know, so how do you feel about that? And you're like, oh God, don't
right.
psychoanalyze me
right.
for God's sakes,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
But if you're with a friend and you're doing something and they're like, but wait, how do you feel about that? It's
right.
the same question.
Yeah.
But what's behind it is not somebody with a notebook that's analyzing you and trying to manipulate you.
Right.
So this is why you can't script this. And I would say that it's actually out of affection for life.
Mm.
There's a really deep affection there. And you know, when you have affection, you enter into the relationship in another way. And it just changes everything. So the affection for the complexity, affection, like, you know, it's like having a big, wonderful crush on life.
Yeah, his affection even made him a bad driver, you said, right?
Yeah,
yeah,
that's right.
Ja, wir sind schon wieder fast am Ende angekommen. Aber ich habe Nora natürlich auch noch ein paar Abschlussfragen gestellt, wie immer. Und die hören wir uns jetzt mal an.
You know that you are a people person if...
person if you know you're a people person.
Okay. If you weren't brought up in this way and established a warm data lab, then?
Then I would be a different person. Hmm. I mean, but that's the thing, right? If you weren't brought up in the way you were brought up, you wouldn't be how you are. If you think about if you were born 15,000 years ago,
right,
who would you be?
Right.
And you wouldn't be this same you, like being really frustrated that you haven't got microphones and laptops to make a podcast. That would
right.
not be who you were.
Right.
So.
You know, originally I wanted to ask or start the sentence with if I didn't come across cybernetics, but... I can't ask that for you because it's something in the way you were brought up. So that's how the question changed, actually.
Oh, that was good.
This conversation in three words.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Three words. Trickling. And wandering. And exploring.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Ja, und da sind wir auch schon wieder am Ende der heutigen Folge angelangt. Was mich an diesem Gespräch mit Nora besonders fasziniert hat, ist, dass sie die Denkweise, die ich hier mit dem Podcast beschreiben und greifen und vermitteln möchte, verinnerlicht zu haben scheint. Bisher lag mein Fokus immer sehr stark auf der Denkweise und jetzt, nachdem ich das Gespräch nochmal erneut gehört habe, sind für mich das Handeln und Fühlen irgendwie viel präsenter geworden. Wie versprochen habe ich noch ein paar weiterführende Hinweise für euch. Und zwar gibt es immer mal wieder Online-Veranstaltungen der Bateson Idea Group. In den letzten beiden Jahren war das zum Beispiel eine Reihe an Bateson Anniversaries anlässlich des 50-jährigen Jubiläums von Ökologie des Geistes, dem Hauptwerk von Gregory Bateson. Und bei diesen Veranstaltungen, ich habe an ein paar von ihnen teilgenommen, war Nora und öfter auch noch andere Gäste, die etwas zu einem bestimmten Thema erzählt haben. Manchmal wurde auch vorher ein Text rumgeschickt, den alle lesen konnten vorab. Und dann wurde eben auch darüber gesprochen, man konnte Fragen stellen, mitdiskutieren. Und wenn euch das interessiert, würde ich euch empfehlen, euch für den Newsletter der Bateson Idea Group anzumelden. Außerdem gibt es noch ein Format, da war ich selbst noch nicht dabei, aber es hört sich auch interessant an. Das heißt People Need People. Und das ist ein Warm Data Lab basiertes Projekt. Außerdem stelle ich euch noch zwei Artikel von Nora in die Shownotes. Ich meine, es sind sogar beide frei zugänglich. Dann gibt es jetzt noch zum Schluss eine Ankündigung. Und zwar wird es zur letzten Folge des Podcasts eine Buchverlosung geben. Diese wird großzügig vom Karl Auer Verlag unterstützt. Und die Bücher werden natürlich alle einen Bezug zu diesem Podcast hier haben. Wenn ihr daran teilnehmen möchtet, dann könnt ihr jetzt schon mal überlegen, was ihr aus dem Podcast mitnehmt. Eine wichtige Erkenntnis oder einen Unterschied, den die kybernetische Denkweise für euch macht. Ich werde dazu in der nächsten Folge noch ein bisschen mehr sagen, aber ich wollte euch auch noch Bescheid geben, dass auch die, die mir eine Frage für die nächste Folge an Monika Bröcker schicken, automatisch an der Verlosung teilnehmen. Also, wenn ihr etwas habt, das ihr gerne jemanden fragen möchtet, der Heinz von Förster noch persönlich kennengelernt hat, dann ist das die Gelegenheit. Schickt mir eure Frage über LinkedIn oder Instagram, dort findet ihr mich unter Lina Nagel, per Spotify-App. Oder per E-Mail an lina.nagel@uni-wh.de. Bis zum 7. April könnt ihr dazu noch etwas einsenden und in der nächsten Folge am 15.04. geht es dann um Kybernetik, Heinz von Förster und dazu habe ich schriftlich vorab Monika Bröcker interviewt. Bis dahin alles Gute, danke fürs heutige Zuhören und euer Interesse. Und macht's gut. Tschüss.
Verstehen zu wollen, was der andere sagt. Und wenn es nicht versteht, dann sagt, liebe, bitte, liebe Gregory Bateson, sag doch noch einmal, was du da gemeint hast. Ich hab's nicht mitgekriegt. Ja, noch einmal die Sache, eine Paraphrase gemacht. So ist ein unerhörtes Gespräch. Mann. Niemand hat von sich gesagt, ich werde ihnen zeigen, sondern ich werde hören, was der sagt. Daher war das eine unglaublich kooperative Gruppe. Das hat mich fasziniert, da habe ich unendlich viel gelernt.